Well, welcome to another edition of El Paso Primetime, and with me this afternoon, Jessica Clute and Jennifer Coulter from Townsend, Ayala & Associates, estate planners and more. First off, ladies, welcome back to El Paso Primetime.
Oh, thank you so much for having us back.
We're always happy to be here.
We're on the cusp of getting back into this whole thing about signing up once again. October 1st is around the corner, and that means Medicaid, Medicare, and all of the issues that come with all of that. So let's just jump into it and see where we go with this.
Okay, sounds fun.
Sure thing. Well, this year we've got some good news and bad news on all of the things that are arising. If we start with Medicare, because we are coming up on the October 1 open enrollment period, one of the really important things that people should know and that they don't always know is that if you are entitled to receive Medicare and you do not start receiving it when you are entitled to, your premiums are going to be bumped above what everyone else's are when you do start to receive it. So if this year is the year that you become eligible, it's really important to make sure that you're enrolled for Medicare.
Yeah, a lot of people think, I'm going to wait until I need Medicare. But in fact, once you need it is when, of course, you're going to need your funds for other types of care probably. And you want to have your premium, that health care premium ends up being pretty pricey and can be incredibly disproportionate if you don't take it as soon as you're eligible for it.
I've seen it be $600 instead of the $104.90 it should be.
Yikes.
Yeah.
So, let's talk about it being disproportionate here. Well, you know, because I always thought that it was going to be, you know, across the board uniform, but evidently not.
Well, as you get older, you're less insurable, Dennis. Mm. So, unfortunately, what they're saying is we want the healthy people in the system, too, to balance out our risk. Mm-hmm. And so as you come in later, you're locking in the price later at whatever age and whatever insurability you are at that time.
Okay. So the questions that our listeners would have, even at this late juncture, would be, well, what's the minimum age to sign up for Medicare?
So you can start to sign up,
I think 62.
As of your 65th birthday. There is early retirement that you may be able to do, but that's a really complicated evaluation. But you need to be signing up when you're 65. If you're disabled, your benefits for Medicare should kick in automatically 2 years after you begin to receive your disability benefits. But for everybody else, when we start looking at turning 65, we want to be sure that we've got that application into Medicare. And I've seen some clients, some of them who are getting the bigger premiums out there, have been told, well, you've got really good health insurance through your employment. You don't need Medicare. You shouldn't be spending the $104.90 a month on those premiums. They're not going to cover what your insurance is covering now. And that's been a big problem for people who have good jobs, who are working and having good insurance, being told, don't get it. And then when they quit working later, as a lot of us are starting to do, is quit working later. When they do quit working and they start going, I'm going to need Medicare, then they're getting hit with these large premiums that they weren't aware that they were going to be having.
Well, you know, it's one of those things that every year we wind up with more and more roadblocks in order to get good health care, it seems like. What's going on?
Well, you know, we're part of the National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys and the Texas chapter of the National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys and the Real Estate and Probate Trust and Law section of the State Bar of Texas. And I will tell you, we're out there working very hard. And there are, in fact, congressmen and you know, we're getting through. You know, it's happening. It's not that it's getting worse. It might seem that way. It's that we're aging and people need it more and the system's more burdened. So we have to find ways to alleviate that burden as they come up.
Right.
And I think that's, you know, part of what's been happening.
Jen. One of the attempts to do that undertaken under the Affordable Care Act was to try to get younger people who, by and large, tend to be healthier and probably as importantly, don't access health care as much, just generally. They will ride out a cold or a flu at home instead of going to the doctor, even when they're insured. So the part of that was to try to get them enrolled in the system because that spreads that risk out for health insurance companies. Part of what they're doing is saying, we're going to take your premiums and we will pay your care. Since we haven't had quite as much youth involvement as we would have liked under the Affordable Care Act. One of the things that's been happening has been a big trend towards health insurance companies doing higher deductibles. And we're looking now at doing a Cadillac tax that would tax people who are having the incredibly low deductible plans. This may affect our office if we get it all instituted.
Incredibly low. Feel incredibly low to me.
Well, okay. I'm looking at this from a pedestrian standpoint because I'm not really understanding the entire magnitude of this whole thing. But from what I'm hearing here, if you're young and you don't sign up for affordable care, you're actually burdening the rest of the system for others who are part of the system?
I hate to say it that way, but you can look at it that way. The way health insurance companies work is by spreading out the risk. And spreading out the risk includes getting healthier people to sign up. The healthiest people among us, as a generalization, tend to be younger. They don't have the kind of chronic health problems that we develop as we age, and they don't tend to access health care as much.
I think also, you know, I believe in preventative medicine, and I think many doctors do as well. Mm-hmm. And if you enter the system younger, the idea would be that you would access more preventative medicine, and ideally it would lower the cost over the long run of your entire health care bill that is footed by the government and the insurance companies, right? Because we're paying premiums. We're not necessarily paying the full cost of our care.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I mean, we say this, and Jen and I, of course, have been in that position of not being insured and being a drain on – we were students, and both of us faced – I would end up in the hospital for whatever reason, and you don't have insurance, and if you don't have the ability to pay, then that goes on the hospital. The hospital mm-hmm. has to find some other way of paying for your care.
If I could real quickly, Dennis, sure. tell you a little bit about me, what happened to me. When I was 22, I was waiting tables to pay my way through college. As I did not have any health insurance. This was pre-Affordable Care Act. There was nowhere for me to get health insurance when my employer didn't really offer it. So I didn't have any health insurance, and I had a 7-inch blood clot in my brain that caused me to go blind. It very nearly killed me, and it meant I spent 3 weeks in the hospital. When I got out of the hospital, I had a $150,000 medical bill, and there was just no way I was going to ever be able to pay it. I fortunately have an incredibly excellent support system that worked their way through the really complicated governmental benefits system and got me Medicaid benefits that were going to go back and pick it up. But when I called the hospital to tell them, they said, oh, we wrote it off. We figured there was just not any way you were ever going to be able to pay it. So they had written off that $150,000, and that debt goes somewhere. And what it goes to is to spread out to the other people who access health care, and this drives up the cost of health care. So for everyone to have health insurance is a wonderful and important thing. That, I think, was the attempt under the Affordable Care Act. How successful it's been, never as successful as we would like.
Mm-hmm. I think one thing to remember if you're thinking about enrolling is the one really wonderful change of the Affordable Care Act is that we no longer insurance companies are no longer able to say, sure, we'll insure you and take your money every month. But when you're sick from that thing you've been sick from your whole life, nuh-uh, I don't want to pay you because that's a pre-existing condition. Okay. And this is, of course, one way in which they can just really, oh, it's all a pre-existing condition. Mm-hmm. Man, that back injury, you know, is really from when you were 12 and you were doing gymnastics. And so what is a pre-existing condition? You know, it has had a profound effect on people that I know in their ability to access health care.
Okay.
So I think if you were worried about maybe I don't want health insurance, remember pre-existing conditions now must be covered. The insurance companies can't use that little idea to try to disqualify you. It's been taken away from them.
Then you still have the people who contend that they don't have to sign up for anything, but they get hit by the IRS on a tax, right?
Yes, and they should be hit by the IRS on a tax. This issue went up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, that's fine. The federal government can force you to participate. Not everyone is subject to that tax. If your income is below a certain dollar amount, and I do not have the figure for it on the top of my head here, but if your income is below a certain threshold, you don't have to sign up or be hit with the tax. So it's for the people who can afford it, who choose not to, who we as a country have said, look, you guys are causing us to be unable to have a healthcare system that is cost effective because you're pushing your risk onto other people by refusing to participate in the system when you will be going to the hospital if you have the medical need for it. If you get in a car accident, if you have an illness or an injury, you're going to the hospital and that's going to be costly. And we don't think it's okay to push that out onto everyone else and have the hospitals write it off and make the healthcare costs higher for the people who are doing it. It's much the same way as Texas forces everyone to have car insurance in order to be a driver.
Right. And that makes a lot of sense.
You can't opt out of trying to stay alive. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't. Mm-hmm. They don't. There's not an option for that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, to me, it's a good idea because I've seen how the model works in Canada on a smaller scale, even though now it's beginning to fail because of the influx of more and more immigrants into their region that kind of put a tax on the entire system. It's not that they're not accepting immigration or anything. It's just that their system was built upon a certain amount in 1960 to 1970. And so here it is, 2015, heading into 2016, and they're still trying to only fit in a certain amount. It's like having a size 9 foot into a size 7 shoe.
It's true. We're mostly making up government as we go along. There is not a guidebook for this is how this is supposed to work. We can't open a manual and say insert slot A into tab B. I'm not sure that's how that works, slot A, tab B. Obviously, I'm not the person in my household who does the mechanical things, but there's not a guidebook for it. We're making it up as we go along, and sometimes we make mistakes. We're trying to accomplish goals, but those often have unintended consequences. And a lot of times, several of our goals will be in conflict with one another. A friendly immigration policy that tries to be compassionate towards other human beings may be in conflict with a system that was set up prior to such a strong influx. And so we're always trying to make adjustments, and that's part of what's been going on in the regulatory system in the past year or so, is trying to make adjustments in how we're doing things to be able to accommodate the changing goals that have happened.
It's an interesting way to look at how we're approaching October 1st and having to sign up for Medicare, Medicaid, everything that goes along with aging. The last figure that I saw, when you ladies came in the last time around, the figure back then was every day 10,000 baby boomers were becoming elder boomers. Well, the latest figure I saw from Pew Research is now it's 12,000 a day. Mm-hmm. And that could that does impact quite a lot of us.
It does. We're aging as a population. We're also living longer as a population. And part of that has been because of the access people have to good health care. Mm-hmm. We did not anticipate when we set up Social Security and Medicare. We're approaching its 60th birthday, I think.
Yeah, something like that.
We didn't anticipate people living so long and our health care being so excellent. Mm-hmm. It's been a really mixed blessing. It's been wonderful for the people who are living longer and having better quality of life as a result, but it's been a real strain on the system as well. And so we're having to figure out how to adapt. That is one of the downsides of what's happened recently with Medicare is that Medicare payments are getting cut quite strongly. So that Medicare is paying less than they have paid in the past. Mm-hmm. This has caused some doctors who used to accept Medicare to stop accepting Medicare. So we're encouraging all of our clients when they're looking at whether they're going with a Medicare Advantage plan or traditional Medicare to talk to their doctors and make sure that they're still going to be covered by that provider as they move forward.
Well, that's a good question that you just posed out there. What's the difference between Medicare Advantage and traditional Medicare?
Jen? all I know is that I've heard it called Medicare disadvantage a couple times.
Okay.
And you've got to be pretty careful about the plan that you pick and really sit down and look at what am I getting with the Medicare Advantage plan versus what I'm getting with traditional Medicare. Medicare Advantage plans are run by private insurance companies, and some of them have really excellent plans, and some of them I've been not entirely thrilled with. A lot of it depends on what you end up needing it for. For my people who end up being in skilled nursing facilities, so this is usually there's an accident, a stroke, a fall, something like that, that results in a 3-midnight stay in a hospital, and then from there a transfer into a rehab facility or nursing facility. For the people who are having that, sometimes the Medicare Advantage plans can be disadvantageous because they tend to backload the payments so that you end up with the upfront cost instead of the upfront 100% coverage. Medicare, traditional Medicare, will cover, in that case, 100% of the first 20 days. And then they can cover a decreasing amount of up to the next 80 days. So it's possible to get 100 days coverage. Not at 100%, but it's possible to get 100 days coverage. And there's been a recent change in the standard of how that works as well. Mm-hmm. The Medicare Advantage plans, some but not all, have been set up so that you start paying that copayment out of pocket during those first 80 days and only get the 100% in the last 20 days. Mm-hmm. But very few people actually make it to the 100-day mark. So a lot of people end up paying more out of pocket in that set of circumstances.
Wow.
There are other circumstances, though, where they can be very good. It's all a matter of sitting down and reading a lot of stuff that doesn't make a lot of sense. We've had some better results since the Affordable Care Act, where we're having more uniform definitions of what things are, what gets covered, what terms mean, so that you're not looking at one plan and having it say one thing, looking at a different plan, having it use entirely different terms and different expressions that mean you can't do a one-to-one comparison and say, what about in this circumstance?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And that's been a positive change under the Affordable Care Act.
The other one that you mentioned, too, the 3-midnight stay, what has changed in that? Jen, if you want to talk about that.
Oh, sure. So we've had a lot of people, especially I do the Medicaid planning in our office. So the people usually come to me on day 19 or 20 of a facility stay and say, I've been told that my parents have to be discharged tomorrow if I don't figure out another way to pay them. And so then we start looking at Medicaid planning. But I also get people coming to my office and saying, we thought that we were being covered by Medicare and we're not. They said that I wasn't in the hospital in the right way. And so there had been this rule that said, if you're in the hospital and you want to trigger that 100 days of Medicare to start running when you get transferred, you need to be admitted for 3 midnights. Well, that seems like a pretty easy thing to understand, right? You go to the hospital, they admit you, you get a room, and you stay for 3 nights.
Right.
But they have two different ways of doing that. They can bring you into the hospital as an admission, or they can bring you into the hospital for observation. And there wasn't a clear way for people to know whether they were being admitted or observed. But now the hospitals are being required to tell people within 24 hours in writing if they're there for observation only. And that way they can plan what they're doing from there. If they can't go to a rehab facility under Medicare days, they need to start looking at making other arrangements. And there are most of the time other arrangements that can be made. But people need to know in advance because it's a big planning situation.
I never knew that 3-midnight rule fell into that category of observation versus admittance.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big thing I'm thinking about it from my standpoint if I get ill.
Mm-hmm.
Good
okay.
God.
It's been a big surprise to a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So my mom would ask this question when she was around. God rest her soul, she would ask, what's the difference between Medicare and Medicaid? Why? What's the whole hubbub about it? And then she would just toddle off and not worry about anything afterwards. And it'll leave me to have to think about it all.
And now we know why you're here.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Well, Medicare is a program that we pay into the system to get. When you're paying into Social Security or to the other federal systems, part of what you're paying in for is your Medicare. Then once you reach the age to get it or you become disabled and get it as a result of that, you start paying your premiums. And from there, you get what is basically a traditional health insurance policy. The important thing to note when you're looking at Medicare and Medicaid, the first important thing to note is Medicare is never, under any circumstances, ever going to cover long-term care. You are maxing out at 100 days. So if you develop a condition that means you're going to need 24-hour-a-day skilled nursing care for the rest of your life, or even just for a year or two while you recover, it's not going to be covered by Medicare. They are a health insurance program like Blue Cross Blue Shield, United Healthcare, any of those programs that you get a health insurance through. They've got deductibles and co-payments you've paid into the system to get them. They are your retirement health care. Medicaid, that's more complicated. We have between 43 and 45 different programs in the state of Texas that we call Medicaid. And I give you that number because there are some Medicaid programs that don't operate everywhere in the state. We have one of the pilot programs here in El Paso. It's active in only two counties in the state. That's the BNVVID program. It's called the PACE program that BNVVID is under.
Okay.
So what Medicaid is kind of breaks down into two different things. It's always going to be means tested. So they're always going to be looking at your income or your income and resources. They're going to be trying to get it to people who really need help. Some of those Medicaid programs, though, we tend to think of them as welfare programs, mm-hmm. the kind of Medicaid that comes with SSI benefits. So the kind of Medicaid I got when I first became disabled, right, that was going to come back and pick up that $150,000 in medical debt. Mm-hmm. That is a welfare program. It does not have to do with your work history. There is no work component to it. But the kind of Medicaid that your mom might have needed to access if she'd needed to stay in a skilled nursing facility has a work component. So it's really for people who worked and paid into the system, yes. but don't have the resources and income to pay for this kind of long-term care. We went and looked at it when people started needing this kind of care and people started realizing just how expensive it was. $4,500 to $6,500 a month or so here in El Paso.
Which is pretty good rates, actually.
Yeah, mm-hmm. we have pretty good rates.
We have some great facilities. I mean,
we do.
I had some personal experience going to facilities, you know, with the care of my grandmother in Austin. And you know, we obviously spend a lot of time with our clients here in El Paso. And there's right. some really, we actually have, you know, there's the horror stories in Texas and potentially, you know, you'll get that in El Paso as well. Everybody needs to watch out for their loved ones.
Right.
But I think we're pretty blessed in El Paso to have the quality of care we have. You know, we need advocates and more people advocating for their loved ones and advocating for the disabled community as a whole. But, you know, there's infrastructure in place.
Mm-hmm.
The question that will always come up because every time we do any type of a show at all about Social Security and Medicare, Medicaid, and the whole nine yards, one of the questions has always been, okay, so what kind of insurance do I need in order to take care of my folks when they go to assisted living?
That would be called long-term care insurance.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so it is essentially too late if they need it now. It's not cost-effective to pay for it from what I've been told, it's not cost-effective for the insurance companies necessarily to even offer them. But if you do it, you know, when you're well enough, you get you can get long-term care insurance. You can get life insurance with living benefits.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that it's either life insurance and mm-hmm. maybe I can pay into it and it can build up value, or I can use it while I'm alive for long-term care. And in that scenario, it's actually more likely that the insurance company is going to lose out, because long-term care can cost very much. You know, if we're talking about years of long-term care, and, you know, in our firm, and we bet on life. Our goal is to have long, healthy, happy lives, and we bet on living a longer life. So if you're making that bet, actually the insurance company will lose in that scenario if you get that particular plan.
Okay. The younger you are and the healthier you are when you try to get long-term care insurance, the more likely it is that you will be able to get it. I personally am, as far as I can tell, after several attempts, a non-underwritable person for long-term care insurance. Jessica is still young enough and healthy enough that she probably can get it and should get it.
I know, but I'm too poor to afford it. I'm 31.
Yeah, well.
But the way most people end up paying for long-term care in Texas and, frankly, across the country, they pay for the short-term with Medicare. They pay for the long-term with Medicaid, VA benefits, and their own money or their family's assistance. I see a lot of cases where the kids come to me after a year or more of paying for their loved one's care and just saying, we can't do it anymore. I can't keep coming up with $6,000 a month to pay for mom's care.
Wow.
We don't know what else to do.
Right.
And the good news is, with very few exceptions, very few people who have paid into the system have unfixable problems for Medicaid purposes for that.
Or their spouse is paid into the system.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we have about 3 minutes to talk about an issue that is quite painful to even think about. And it's one that you brought up before we started taping. And it really hurts to know that some of our wounded veterans can't get the type of health care that is afforded others.
Well, they still can try to make Medicaid applications, but the VA has just worked really hard to make it much, much harder for our veterans to get aid and attendance. So we set up a program where our wartime veterans who served their country during wartime and were honorably discharged could get assistance when they needed it if their income and resources were below a certain amount. And now they have, of their own initiative without Congress, even though they told us Congress needed to do it, set it up to say, we're going to trigger penalty periods and make you not eligible at any time for a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
If you've transferred assets for less than what they were worth, and we don't care why you did it. We're presuming you did it to get benefits, even if you didn't. So if you paid for your kid's wedding and then you had a stroke, we're going to penalize you for paying for your kid's wedding. If your kid needed a kidney and you paid for that, you're out of luck. There's no way to get around it. There's no exception. We're expecting this to come into effect sometime in fiscal year 2016, which starts October 1. They've said they're going to start looking at implementing it probably somewhere around February 1, 2016, but they won't be more precise than that. And we don't know whether they're going to grandfather in transfers that happened before it. So we're in a really tough limbo state where our veterans are going to get really hurt, because anybody else making a regular Medicaid application for that can say, I did this for a solely non-Medicaid purpose,
mm-hmm.
and I can provide proof of that. I was in good health. I paid for my kid's wedding, and then I had a stroke. Mm-hmm. But the veteran can't at this point.
So is there no way that a federal injunction can stand in the way of this?
I don't do administrative law, but we just got back from the big NALA conference, the Texas chapter of the NALA conference, recently this month, and everyone is under the impression that it's not going to stand, that they don't have the authority to do it. But that's going to take a long time to work its way through the court systems. And in the meantime, veterans are going to get hurt. It's very important for our veterans right now to go and talk to someone about their potential need for benefits and what they're doing with their estates, and make sure they're getting really good planning in place, because we just don't ever know what's going to happen. And our wartime veterans really need to be protected. This is a big, just unprecedented change that the VA has just done of their own initiative without any action from Congress.
Yeah, you might notice Jen's not so happy about that.
No.
I'm incredibly displeased. I'm very hot about it right now.
Well, it's a hot topic because it's something that's really going to affect quite a large percentage of our population, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm. You know, in El Paso in particular.
Yeah,
especially.
Exactly. And it's not fair. You serve your country, and for what?
Fair happens once a year in Dallas, sir.
It's not the only place that we're hurting our veterans and treating them unfairly either in this system. If we have some time the next time, if you have us back, I'd love to tell you about the way that we're hurting people who are getting their disability determinations through the Veterans Administration, the Civil Service, the Railroad Retirement, and the Teachers Retirement System.
We need to talk about that. So, yeah. Mi casa, su casa, we'll go ahead and do this. let's plan on this in about 3 or 4 weeks. After the Halloween thing is all over and done with, come on back and in November, let's talk about this because it's vitally important that we update everyone on this.
We'd love to come back.
Our pleasure.
Thank you so much for having us, Dennis.
Spread the word.